Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
This is no happy week. All there is pain and suffering.
This is true. We will not be talking about the Mets in any way, shape, or form other than this mention that we won't be talking about them because life is awful, baseball is awful, and the San Francisco Giants can die in a fire.
At least we didn't lose to the Cardinals. And we move on.
You know what? I feel like I'd rather lose to the Cardinals.
Oh, I don't know. The Cardinals are pretty miserable. No, I know you live in California. You have more exposure to Giants-dom than I do.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, in general, like, people know at this point how repulsive Cardinals fans are. Like, if people spent more time with Giants fans, they'd realize that they're pretty much everything you hate about Cardinals fans, plus everything you hate about Red Sox fans, plus everything you hate about Patriots fans, plus everything you hate about the worst part of Florida State's fandom, the worst part of Ohio State's fandom, and like Notre Dame fans.
Sounds like a fun mix.
Yeah, they are a joy to be around. But anyway, moving on. Syracuse football plays a game this week. They'll be facing Wake Forest, but for now we can talk a little bit about what happened last week. Dan, things were always close, but never close enough to give us hope. At least that was kind of my read on the situation after probably the first 5 minutes. You knew that no matter what happened, SU's secondary was a sham. I don't really understand why, if you're Notre Dame's offensive coordinator, you didn't just bludgeon the hell out of the secondary the entire game, because I mean, those passes were there pretty much all afternoon if Notre Dame wanted them, but they didn't. They still won 50-33. I thought SU looked better than that score might indicate on offense, but on defense, obviously worse. Your at least initial takes now that you've had about 4 or 5 days to digest the results and everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of the issues that we have long thought about this Syracuse defense kind of came to a head. And for all of Notre Dame's problems this year, playmakers on offense is not one of them. Obviously, everyone became very well acquainted with Equanimeous St. Brown, who is one of the more impressive, like, big targets in college football. And he just absolutely shredded us. You had this Kevin Stevenson home run touchdown. Torrey Hunter, like, they have a lot of weapons on offense. Offense in general is not their issue, even though it's been spotty at times. But Syracuse's defense just isn't nearly where it needs to be to slow down an attack like that, and the offense isn't where it needs to be to win a shootout with a team that has guys like Deshaun Kaiser and St. Brown and Josh Adams, who, you know, had a nice game. Dexter Williams obviously cut us up a little bit. So I don't think any of it's particular. I think the manner in which they scored and, like, those one-play drives and stuff, it might be a little bit shocking, but I think that was mostly balanced out by, like, you know, Syracuse actually made some nice stops, and the red zone defense is, for whatever reason, like, kind of a bright spot, strangely. So I think it ended up being about what we thought, maybe a little higher scoring in Notre Dame's end, but not much. I think we were all predicting kind of, like, mid to high 40s for them. Nothing too crazy except for, like, the manner in which, like, points were traded off like wildfire in that first, like, 5 minutes. But overall, I think the numbers kind of bear out relatively close to expectation.
Yeah, I mean, I know everyone was kind of, I feel like everyone was a little under 20 point, you know, range in this one. I mean, I had SU was my, like, 11. Everyone had kind of varied. I don't really think 17 is that far off. I think a lot of folks who were, I mean, even myself, I was definitely found myself much more down about the result immediately afterward than I did a few hours afterward and a few days afterward, as I continued to kind of look back on it, and then I rewatched the game and all that on Monday night. Things definitely didn't seem as bad or as dire as maybe the initial score and the box score looked. There were a few disconcerting things. I mean, I don't think we need to talk about the defense much anymore. I will say the red zone defense is encouraging. It's obviously mostly a result of, you know, shortening the field so that there isn't, you know, a 50-yard kind of swath of land in front of them after they get past SU safeties. I could take as many of these you know, kind of goal line stands as they can give us. But obviously, if you're going to be letting up 72-yard touchdowns or so, it's going to be hard to have too many of those. But on the offensive side, I think, you know, there were still some issues. I think Dungy was definitely under pressure a lot in the second half, and against a young offensive line, that's tough. And they really, you know, Notre Dame really wasn't blitzing much. They were dropping, you know, 7 or 8 into coverage, and then just creating coverage sacks with 3 and 4 man fronts, you know, trying to pursue Dungy. It was a little bit easier in that second half as they kind of got a read for what him and the offense were doing. 31-51 is not really anything to like feel bad about, but at the same time, when you look at the drops, there was about 5 of those. There were another 2 or 3 overthrows. You know, Dungy could have easily been, you know, over 70%. Can't be understated, at least in my book, how much he's improved in the short amount of time in this offense. And I know you and I have talked about it before. Like, Dungy's a really smart guy, and like, I don't think that should be lost on anyone how he's changed his running style. Yes, he still has some issues when it comes to taking risks, but I think he does make adjustments on the fly, and he does learn from mistakes, even if it takes a week to do so. So he might harp on the same mistake over and over in one game, but then, you know, after a week of film review and talking to coaches and things like that, you definitely see a different player. You're seeing him go over the middle more. You're seeing him avoid, you know, dangerous hits, going out of bounds more, making the smart play to throw it out of bounds when he's under pressure. So, yeah, I think at least starting this conversation about the offense and what it could do, I think we should start discussing first what it can do and what it has done, and that's largely because of the adjustments that Dungy has made.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you can see it even in a game where he had 17 carries, you know, with kind of mixed results, but stored 3 times, which is great, because that's helped solve some of the red zone offensive issues that we've had. When you have a dual threat guy and a guy who can effectively run the read option, I mean, that's a pretty dangerous weapon down by the goal line. Even just like taking blows, obviously he took the one, which nothing he could really do about the one he did take. It was a late hit, it was flagged. But he's being much safer with not letting himself get absolutely walloped like we saw a little bit earlier this year and then obviously so many times last year. So it's hard to really complain when you have a guy who had, like, what, 410 yards of total offense and 5 touchdowns. Like, that's a pretty decent day. And I thought it was probably one of his better overall throwing performances, where he's been kind of mixed at points in previous weeks, the win over UConn and the loss to South Florida. I thought this was a pretty nice performance overall by him. And he didn't even have, like, Edetawo going too crazy. Obviously, he had a nice game, too, but it wasn't like he was just, like, overwhelming. It was a nice performance by a couple guys. I was actually really encouraged by Steve Ishmael got into the offense more so than he has in the last couple weeks. Nothing huge, but he was getting open, and hopefully that's a continued shift in terms of balancing out this offense a little bit.
And Dungy overthrew him on that one ball. That would have been a good, what, 55-yarder or so?
Yeah,
I mean, that's the second straight week that, you know, Ishmael dropped one against UConn in the end zone, and then he was overthrown, you know, wide open down the field in this one. You know, Ishmael's saying to media that, you know, he's fine to wait his turn. I think that's dead on. He's always been a pretty positive guy since he joined the team, and I think that, you know, he understands now, like, you already saw it in this game, like, when Notre Dame adjusted and, you know, Edetawo didn't get a target in the first drive because they were moving the ball well, moving it around to other folks. He didn't really get many targets in the third quarter either. But in the second and the fourth, you saw a lot of him kind of at 2 different junctures where the game seemed to be separating a little bit and Syracuse, I mean, Notre Dame's corner stopped pressing. That's when you saw Edetawo really go to work. And the fact that you can call a 7-catch, 134-yard effort pedestrian is a testament to how well he's done so far. And in general, you know, it's crazy, I think, still. I mean, we're 5 games into this new system at this point, but it is crazy to think of, you know, that performance as a down game for anybody in an orange uniform.
Yeah, I mean, he's just been, like, so prolific. I mean, the fact that this would be what his worst game, I guess the South Florida game he didn't store, but, like, when you have a guy who can go out there and you know he's going to get 100 yards and probably find the end zone, like, every week, that's, I mean, anyone who plays fantasy football knows that's kind of, like, invaluable. so, Yeah, I mean, nothing he's done can really be understated. He's been one of the best receivers in college football, pretty plainly. And it doesn't look like he's really going to slow down, aside from, you know, maybe facing more double teams, which I still think will come. Notre Dame did a little more of it than some other teams have. But that's why it's important that Ishmael and Phillips and the rest of the team gets brought in along here. Although if people want to keep on leaving him in single coverage, that's fine. Go to what works. No reason to overthink the offense.
No, and, there were a couple new wrinkles, I thought. I mean, that one Irv Phillips run inside the 30 was really nice. I hope we see more of that. Because, you know, it kind of gave hope to the Irv Phillips should be a running back crowd like you and me, even if we're the only people left on that boat.
That was literally my first thought when I saw it. I was like, oh, he's so good running the ball.
I mean, it's also the unexpected on a play like that, where he's obviously taking folks by surprise. But yeah, Irv did such a great job running the ball. He's so much better at operating in a small amount of space than Strickland is. Strickland is fantastic in the open field, and that's why I love him as a receiver, because I think that he does a really nice job with space. I feel like Phillips does a really nice job in close quarters, and that's why you see him doing so well with these short passes in the flat, that he's, you know, managing to catch in these bunch formations along with that Atawo. Another thing I did see, at least looking through the box score, and I noticed this in the play calling breakdown too, was, you know, how they were really getting some more names involved and trying to cycle people in and out. Since Esteem, you know, came back in to take care of punts, and he does a very good job with, you know, returning those, he was definitely a little more out of breath than normal at the beginning of drives, which then kind of started shuffling in some other guys at the slot position, specifically Sean Riley and Devin Butler, who ended up with four catches combined for 50 yards, which I think is a pretty nice day for the two of them. Then I also felt that, you know, using Dr. Strickland as a receiver, I felt like they didn't do a ton of that thus far. But using Strickland as a receiver, especially when they went five wide a bunch and put him out in motion after calling out the scheme, did seem to have an impact, even if the game was a little too far gone at that point. And I'd like to see maybe a little bit more of that going forward.
Yeah, I especially agree with the Brizzly point. I mean, I just think he's such a weapon returning punts that I think it's worth holding him out on first or second down, putting in Butler, who I thought looked pretty decent for what he, you know, put out there, and Riley. Trade him, you know, I'm fine trading a couple plays at the beginning of a drive, especially when our drives tend, you know, we don't have a ton of three and outs, for the impact that he puts on punt returners. But because as we especially learned this weekend, Syracuse is not in a position where it can really, no pun intended, punt on special teams at any point of the game. So when you have like an elite level person on one of those groups, like, just use them. I think, and I don't really think Brizzly's been utilized in the offense as much as a lot of us probably thought or hoped. So if that's a trade you're going to make, where he's, you know, missing out a couple plays where he's not really being thrown the ball, and it's funny because I say that, and he has 18 catches, which is more than he had last year, total, and more than he had in 2014, fewer than he had in 2013. But yeah, I mean, if you're going to miss a couple plays on offense, I think the potential for a game-changing punt return, and he had a couple that, if the game wasn't as out of hand, like, could have been game-changing plays or you know, similar plays to what he had in that Minnesota bowl game. I just think that's a worthy trade.
Yeah, and I mean, when you consider how bad things are in special teams right now, the fact that we have one guy you can trust with the ball in his hands and that entire unit, just give him the damn ball. I think it's insane that there was any sort of shift away from him, who was an all conference contender, at the punt return spot last year. The fact that he was ever shifted off, I understand why, but I think that the positive result, especially given how terrible his defense is, when you can force a punt, your ability to flip the field is critical. Especially with how this offense too has been able to bog down in the second and third quarters. I mean, I know you and I have talked about it. Like, if you look at Bill Connolly's numbers, you know, SU is a top 25 offense in the first quarter. Then they're a bottom 25 offense in the second and third quarter every game, because of how production seems to slow. So yeah, any sort of advantage they can pick up there in terms of field position and in terms of getting closer to the end zone, where they've actually. They actually did pretty well. They were 4 of 5 from the red zone this past week, which was the most trips they've had in any game this year. And on top of that, you know, the fifth was really just a drop by or Phillips away from being 5 for 5. So I think, you know, encouraging signs there. Said the fact that we weren't settling for field goals in part by necessity did help us out. I felt like there was better execution. The one thing, and I know I brought it up in Slack a little bit and in the play calling article, Dan, do you think some of the play calls might be getting a little too predictable and the patterns getting a little too repetitive, at least looking week over week? It seems like there's a lot of similarities to start games and a lot of similarities where the team just kind of hits a wall and drive three.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty adept observation by you. As you noted in our Slack conversations, it seems like the scripted plays early in the game, which is all your observation, I'm just taking credit for it now. The scripted plays in the first like drive or two tend to work a lot better than when, you know, the game gets going. And I'm not sure if some of that is the fact that Syracuse is likely giving up points on some of those drives going on, or it's just a matter of, you know, you can only strip plays so long before you need to start to adjust to the game situation. But it definitely does seem like it's possible that that's where the change comes. And I wonder if it's the lack of a running game really catches up with the team going forward. Because, you know, at some point, corners adjust to like the tendencies of receivers and the defense kind of learns to adjust to the pace of the game. And that's where having an effective running game where you can kind of dictate that tempo a little more and effectively grind down a defense, even when you are playing at tempo, might help matters. And Syracuse just doesn't have that.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, you just had to look at the numbers and see what Dungy's putting up on the ground. He's the only one moving the ball. These run pass options have their pluses and minuses. They're great when he's able to grab big gains. They're not when he isn't. I know we talked about this a little bit too, and this is kind of, does the run pass option and having a lot of the playbook kind of up to Dungy, like once you get past those first few drives that are scripted, is that part of the cause of the drop-off? Is that, you know, kind of like Tim Lester did last year, you put a lot of faith in Dungy to make these decisions. He's a smart guy. He's going to make the decision. But after a while, you know, he can only go so far. He can only see so much from where he is versus, you know, I mean, plus Babers calls his own plays. Babers is calling his own plays from the sideline, not the box. He's not, I mean, yes, he has, you know, his guys up there kind of calling out what they see. But with a fast offense, you're only going to be able to relay so much information in a short amount of time. So I guess, like, do you think all those factors might be playing in as well? Dan, you're on mute.
Sorry about that. My phone just, like, did not want to let me unmute. yeah, I was, like, kept on hitting it. It just kept on flashing off. Yeah, no, I think those are all possible. It's tough to really know without like getting into Dino Babers' head, because like pretty much every other college football coach, he's not going to just give everything away or give you that much detail. But I think those are all distinct possibilities, and I'm interested to see what happens as we go along, because I think there's a chance that this actually gets better rather than worse, because the offensive line, health, like both health wise and in terms of playing a lot of guys who probably weren't expected to be big contributors this year, definitely is an issue. So whether or not guys get healthy, or you have an improvement in terms of, you know, just the younger guys developing and getting brought along a little quicker than they would normally, I think there's a chance that this gets better. And also the fact that, you know, we have you know, some more manageable opponents coming forward. Obviously, you still have Clemson and Florida State, but you also have, like, this weekend, Wake Forest, which has done some nice things this year, but it's a pretty big drop-off in terms of talent from Notre Dame, at least. I know Wake has a transitive property win over Notre Dame this year, but I don't think that matters about much. And then, you know, at BC in a couple of weeks, Virginia Tech is kind of an interesting game. I'm not sure what to really make of the Hokies.
spread off,
I don't think we'll...
I think spread offense equals depth this year.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're going to win it, but I think there's a chance that, you know, maybe, I don't know, we'll see what happens with that. I mean, I guess they snuck into the top 25 this week, so good for them. But I'm more interested in, even though Notre Dame has struggled this year, I still think they're probably a top 20 talented team. And what they do well is really not great for what Syracuse does poorly. So I'm much more interested in seeing where this team measures up against Wake this weekend and BC and NC State and Pitt, rather than like the Notre Dames and the Clemsons and the other teams that are throwing much better athletes out there.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, you know, like we said from the beginning, you know, this is year one of a several year process. So I think, you know, going up against elite athletes in a similar system, like we saw at Louisville, like we saw at USF, like we'll see with Clemson to a point, like we saw with Notre Dame to a point, you know, they're just not solid comparisons right now. You're not going to be able to out-scheme a much more talented team when they have a similar scheme to you, even if they're not playing at the exact same tempo. And they just have better talent on defense. You look at a team that has similar talent across the board and doesn't play at the same pace. You know, whether it's, I mean, UConn has less talent, but a team like Wake, a team like you said, NC State, Boston College is a little less talent on their roster. I think Pitt might be a little bit higher up just because they have been recruiting at a top 35 or so level for a few years. Especially since they joined the ACC, it seems like they've taken a little bit of a step forward. I think that, you know, those three games, you know, again, the NC State, the Wake, and the BC game are going to be very indicative of what this team is in year one. And I think if they can pull off two out of three of those, everyone should feel really, really good about where we're headed next year. You know, it's only a matter of time before, you know, this system sneaks up on someone it's not supposed to. And it could have been Notre Dame last week if a few other things fell the right way. I mean, I wouldn't say it was a close loss by any means. But, you know, if you look at some missed opportunities by the offense, some drops and things like that. And then you mentioned the offensive line there. Kevin had a great piece a couple days ago where he was talking about, you know, how it just seems like no one's talking enough about how much these injuries have had an impact, you know, how much this line kind of mismatch and you know, lack of game experience is really hurting SU. And like you said, the running game is just it's just bad, and it's bad because we don't have a power back necessarily, and I feel like that's what you need to really get this this system going. And maybe it's Fredericks if he ever gets out of the doghouse. But you look at that, you look at the lack of the running game. I mean, this is a run first offense. I know everyone was expecting 40-50 passes a game, and we're getting it, but those 40-50 passes per game are a lot more effective if you have 30-40 runs per game or 40-50 runs per game. You know, look at something like Baylor. I mean, what Baylor did against Iowa State isn't anything to brag about from a final score perspective, but Baylor still managed, you know, 469 yards on the ground on 62 attempts, which is insane. But that's also the school of thought that that Babers came from, and it's the efforts like that are probably going to color his, you know, worldview a lot more than what you see at Texas Tech and the kind of Pirate Leach air raid style of spread.
Yeah, and even Leach has incorporated a little more rushing in his offense the last couple of years. I think unless you have a ridiculous set of receivers and a elite quarterback, like, you need to be able to run the ball a little bit. And I know we talked about it last week, some of these screen passes, which were very mixed this past weekend, especially the tunnel screens that they tried, which seemed like kind of a new wrinkle.
And not good one.
Not a great wrinkle. The kind of wrinkle you get dreamed for. That can be an extension of it. But overall, like you said, I mean, go look at Baylor last year. By the way, it just kills me every time that we have to bring up Baylor as the team for frame of reference.
Please lose.
Yes. But, I mean, look at what they did last year. They lost all their quarterbacks, and they turned into a spread option team that only ran the ball. So I think there's, like, kind of a misnomer that's a very, like, all-passing, all-day offense. And at times it did become more of that, because that was something that Bryce Petty was a little more adept at, even though he was also athletic. But they really kind of play to the strength of their players. And right now the strength of Syracuse's players is the almost air raid level of passing breakdown. But I don't think that is ideal for what this offense tries to be. I think it is a very balanced attack when utilized at full go. And I think Colin Byrne, I'm pretty sure it was him that said that this week. He said, you know, Deion Bayers was a running back. He wants to run the ball. Unfortunately, we've tried to establish a run every game. It's just not effective. And you need to move the ball. And Bayers, he's going to do the things that are most effective in that game. For the most part, that's his strategy. Obviously, we have some questions about his decisions to punt in this Notre Dame game, which he deflected in a very coachy way, which, you know, we can hope we found a unicorn, but, you know, he is still a football coach, so he's going to do the things that football coaches do. But overall, I think in an ideal world, when we move forward and get some linemen in that are both healthy and mesh as a unit and learn how to play in this style, because it's probably as big an adjustment for them as anyone coming from a very, very slow plotting offense, I think we'll start to see a little bit more of what this should look like, and hopefully that's later in the year. Obviously, I'm not expecting everyone to, you know, this thing to start clicking by week 10 at full go, but I think we'll have a better idea of what the ideal Syracuse offense looks like, whether it's because linemen are healthy or because the young guys are coming along at the pace that you'd expect when they've been thrust into starting roles.
Too true. Before halftime, I do want to touch on a little bit of that fourth down stuff. That's really starting to kill me. Last two games in particular, felt like we really kind of ceded a lot of our opportunities to change the course of the game, to flip the field a little bit, especially with how, I mean, the punting game is not, the punting game hasn't fallen off necessarily as much as people would think. A couple shanks by Hoffrichter and everyone's losing their minds. When I wrote up stuff on Monday about the special teams play, the big difference between Hoffrichter and Riley Dixon, other than trick plays working well, is that Dixon was able to pin teams quite a bit, within the 20 or even the 10. Hoffrichter hasn't necessarily mastered that, but because of the pace of offense, if SU starts, you know, closer to their own goal line, he's also progressing less. So Hoffrichter can, you know, pull off, I think he had one like 50 yard or so punt last week, but because it was coming from like the 10, you know, it didn't look like it went as far. His averages are maybe a yard less than what Dixon's were last year. So I'm not necessarily panicking there, but, Babers, for a guy who talks a lot about being aggressive and going for it on fourth down and all this other stuff, I think we've only had two attempts in the last two games on fourth, and both of them were in this past game, and there were three or four other times in this past game we could have done it. There was another two or three at least against UConn we could have. I think that if I'm questioning anything this year, it's that decision that's really starting to derail what this offense is supposed to be about at certain junctures.
Yeah, and I'm not going to like totally lose my mind, because I think that even with, you know, we have this ideal world where, Bayers went for every single fourth down, and obviously, you know, then when it doesn't work, we have to keep our, you know, heads in terms of not, you know, thinking the wrong way and just trusting the process. But I think he's still way ahead of like 95% of other college coaches. Like, the punting too often and relying too much on that unit is not a Bayers problem. I mean, it's a problem with the vast majority. I'm saying like over 95% of coaches at every level. So I think that Bayers is definitely ahead of most of those guys. It's just not quite where he seems to totally stick with his guns every drive. And I'd like to see that. I would like to, it's early in his tenure, but I'd like to have a comfortability with the staff where I see a situation come up and I'm like, yep, this will be it. He will go for this because it's Deion Bayers and this is a thing he goes for pretty much every time. And he doesn't worry too much about outside factors that might not play into the decision as much as logically, as much as, you know, other coaches who worry about a lot of other stuff that probably doesn't have the impact that they think it does.
Completely agree. I think that's a good place to stop for halftime. Dan, what have you been drinking?
A limited amount. As I said last year, I've been on antibiotics, so I had to not go too crazy, and the beers I had were mostly unexciting. But on the flip side, I am going to this Wake Forest game that will hopefully not be in a hurricane
in Winston-Salem. I leave tomorrow, and I only have like one more day of these antibiotics, so okay. I'm looking to get into some Foothills and some other good stuff, because North Carolina has wonderful beer. So I will report back with hopefully a pretty full array of things next weekend, and not the normal New York stuff.
Do it. Go drink some Wicked Weed.
Yes, I look forward to it.
Yep. Pernicious IPA is probably one of my favorite IPAs, and that's saying a lot considering how many I drink out here. So yeah, if you can find that, would highly recommend.
I don't think I've had that one, so I will be on the lookout for it.
Yeah, it is in bottles, so it's definitely around. On my end, I had a few things. I was just kind of out and about on Friday watching the Mets, and there's a sports bar that happened to, I didn't even ask them to, they had the Mets on like three TVs and Stanford, Washington on the rest. So I was doing that. I drank some 24th Street Pale Ale from Strand Brewing, which is local. Grapefruit Broad Acres with Simcoe. Just a beer from Phantom Carriage, which is local over in Carson. I found Pete's Port, surprisingly. I know I talked about Graveyard's Pale Ale a couple weeks ago that I had down in the Solano Beach location for a Pete's Port. They actually ended up canning it, so had a couple of those while I was homebrewing with the beer that Dan has aptly dubbed the Disloyal Pale Ale. Once it's ready to taste.
Oh, you haven't? Is that still being worked on?
Yeah, it's we're probably probably 2 or 3 weeks out from like actual tasting, but right now it's still kind of finalizing the fermentation part of things, and then we'll let it sit for a bit.
Very nice.
So I will report back on that one once it's done. Other things I had, Beechwood is their Green Shift Double IPA, which was just as excellent this year as it always was. And then a brewery with their Sans Pajai. I think that's how you pronounce it. There's too many Belgian names that they use. But yeah, basically it's a Belgian-style creek, sour blonde aged in barrels with cherries. It's very, very good beer, very tart. Now, my first experience with it a few years back, felt like it was going to take the enamel right off my teeth, which was not a fun experience, and I had heartburn for days. This time, the last couple of years, actually, they've done a nicer job of balancing it. So I much, much appreciate that on their end. Anyway, moving on. Syracuse Wake Forest. Dan will be there. I will not this time around. But yeah, Syracuse is the polar opposite of Wake in a lot of ways. But at the same time, Wake is 4-1. They pulled off a couple nice wins this year. They have seemingly looked better. I think they steadily improved week over week until we got to this past week's game against NC State, when they looked pretty bad. John Wolford will almost definitely be starting on Saturday, which means we don't have to worry about as much of the dual threat of Kendall Hinton as we once would have, but Wolford can run himself and has run on us before. I feel like a lot of these defenders, even if the scheme isn't necessarily familiar, a lot of these defenders should at least have some recollection of what John Wolford does. Dan, other than the hoping for no hurricane force winds and rain, what are you expecting down at BB&T Field?
I'm not honestly all that sure. I haven't had a chance to watch Wake this year, even in their, and I'm fitting this in totally organically, their exciting 7-3 win over Tulane.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly they're an improved team, although I don't know that a win over Duke tells you a ton. I know Duke beat Notre Dame, but Duke's also looked pretty awful.
I think a loss to Duke tells you a ton.
Yeah. yeah. Win over Indiana probably looks a little nicer and on the road. But then they lost to NC State, and I don't know what to make of NC State, because NC State hasn't really played anyone, because it's NC State and they never play anyone. Overall, I mean, I'm not really afraid of this passing attack, especially I think I'd rather play Wolford than Hinton for the reasons you've outlined. I mean, he's under 6 yards an attempt. That's not very good. I know he's had his moments, but he just doesn't scare me. This offense overall, like, it's probably a little better than it has been.
You still don't have the targets, though. Like, they don't – there's they've had guys they can throw to in the past. That's not the case this year. Like, Serena is probably the only guy that, like, I have any legitimate amount of concern for. Like, in the past, we've actually seen, like guys like Michael Campanaro, like, actually, like, receivers. And those teams have proceeded to put up nothing against us without any real receivers or any guys that I would really bank on. I'm not really sure, even if Wolford is playing well, who he's going to be getting the ball to.
Yeah, I haven't seen enough from this Wake team. Nothing, like, totally stands out. Just even beating Indiana, I mean, Indiana's defense is not good. So it's not like putting 33 on them is, like, this huge, you know, coming out party, even if 33 points for Wake Forest tends to be a lot. So, yeah, I think it'll be I think it'll probably be the closest game we've had since joining the ACC. Because Syracuse is, for whatever reason, just, like, really whooped up on Wake the last couple of years. I don't know. I feel pretty confident about it. I think a lot of that is, on my part, probably just, you know, having watched this game however many years in a row now and seeing since that game, the first game of the Dome when Campanaro went out. I think that was the last team coached by Jim Grobe. Since then, I mean, the Tolleson era just has not been kind to, or has just not been good for Wake in this series. So I'm probably a little colored by that, but the numbers just don't look drastically different than what they did last year. The team has no explosiveness. It limits it pretty well, which is kind of similar to past teams, which had some nice defensive backs and some highly ranked players there. It just seems like it's probably like a slightly better version of what Wake's been for a while here, and that doesn't really scare me.
Yeah, agreed. And I mean, you know, I don't even have an issue with how they've scheduled here. I don't think they really scheduled totally poorly, but they've scheduled wins, and they put themselves in a situation to be 4-1 right now. That's smart on their part. It's not smart on ours that we didn't. But that is what it is. I mean, you're right. Wake doesn't necessarily look like they're, you know, head and shoulders above what this team has been in the past. And again, it was proven by them being beat by an NC State team who I think their ceiling is probably around 6-6 or so. I mean, they lost to a mediocre-ish ECU team. I didn't think they looked great against William and Mary, whoever else they played. Like, I'm never impressed by State, and I know that, like, that's one of, like, the longstanding biases on this podcast, that, like, never be impressed by NC State under any circumstances. But, I think that's a product of what they are under Dave Dorn, and we can talk plenty more shit about NC State later on when we face them. Like you said, Wake, them scoring 30 is a major accomplishment. I don't think they've ever scored 30 on us, actually, which even in that overtime game, which spells some bad things for them. I looking over more of, like, Wolford's statistics, like, he doesn't put the ball in the end zone. He's throwing under 57%, like you said, you know, less than 6 yards per attempt. I mean, this is, it's the same thing you and I said before the UConn game, maybe even more so, to be honest, because I feel like, I mean, there's actually a running game here for once, but I feel like UConn was better at running the ball. A team that runs at a pace like this and runs an offense like this where you're not explosive, you can't make up ground in a hurry, it's going to be very difficult. It's going to be more difficult, to be honest, as the year goes on, to beat Syracuse if you find yourself down, you know, 14, 21 points very quickly.
Yeah, and Syracuse's tendency to jump on people while, you know, they did it to UConn, and UConn clawed its way back and almost won the game.
Well, we did nothing for, like, 2.5 quarters.
Right. You can't always bet on Syracuse just totally going in the tank. I don't think we have enough data yet to, like, say definitively that Syracuse will never be able to score in the middle quarters. It seems that way now, but I don't know that we can make that determination. You were right. Wake has never scored 30 points in Syracuse. The two programs have played five times since 06. The closest they came was in the overtime game. They scored 29. Syracuse, which is those of you listening to the podcast are acutely aware not fielded a great offense in that time frame, and has scored an average of 23 points, which is brought down by a 13 and a 10.
Ooh, can I guess all the scores without looking?
Yes, let's do this. This is great. All right, 2006.
2006 was 20 to 10.
Yes. 2011.
2011 was... Was it...
That was a 20 to 10 Wake Forest win. That was the only win in the series for Wake.
Yes, so I have been either a student or a holder of a Syracuse degree for every one of these games.
I have been to four of these games. The only one I wasn't was I was, you know, 16 in high school at the 06 game.
Was that 33-29?
No, 36-29.
I thought that. The other game...
2013 was the Campagnaro died game, yes. Which was sad.
We had 13-0, 30-7.
Yep.
And then last year's game was 31-10?
30-17.
Oh.
Pretty good, though. Pretty good effort.
Did what I could. Actually, the fact, it's actually less surprising that I got the furthest one away, right?
Yeah, so you nailed three. And then the other ones, you were off by a total of 3 points in 2011 and a total of 8 points last year.
Killing it.
Just really strong effort.
All right, so that's your history of Wake. I know I put this article up last year. I might actually repost it this year. My Syracuse and Wake make for strange bedfellows article that got some like weirdly positive reception from both sides of just like this odd link we have with one another and how we've knocked an important member of the Wake Forest offense out of every game we've played against one another.
Yeah, we have
every single one.
It was what Walford a couple of years ago. The last time we were at Wake, no, it was
going
Walford.
All the way to 06.
Who was 06? Oh, it was yeah. Well, that didn't really help.
We set up. Like, we set up the Riley Skinner era.
And then it was Campagnaro in 2013. Who was in 2011?
In 2011,
the overtime game.
In 2011, I know. No, we knocked.
It was
Price
someone.
Out. We knocked Price out in the 2011. Oh, game.
Right.
And then, I think we knocked Walford out of the last two games.
Yeah, I think you're right. Because like I remember the last game at Wake where we briefly met at halftime. Wake's offense was just the worst thing. It was just by like Syracuse was not a good offensive team.
AJ Long's greatest hour.
It was AJ Long. It was an AJ Long game, and it was like one of those things where Syracuse scored 30 points. So we're like, oh, the offense looked pretty good, and you realize I think like 14 of those points came directly from the defense, or like the defense left the ball, like the two. So it wasn't like the offense was actually all that great, but the defense had a really nice game, and Wake's offense just not good.
I honestly, that makes me think about like the Syracuse quarterbacks I've seen live. And like the list makes me angry,
the quarterbacks you'll know.
No, because the last three games I've seen Zach Mahoney, AJ Long, and Terrell Hunt in that order, going backwards. Ryan Nassib, the only game I saw him start was his final game, and then I saw Greg Paulus a bunch. I saw a lot of Andrew Robinson, a lot of Perry Patterson, and what's his name? Who was in there? Shit. Who started the Notre Dame game in Greg's second to last game?
Oh, Cam Dantley.
Yeah, there you are. So, yeah, that's my roster of Syracuse quarterbacks, largely populated by, I'd say, ranking-wise, Andrew Robinson most. Patterson, Paulus, Dantley, and then, yeah, I've yet to see Eric Dungy, and I'm probably not going. And who knows if I ever get to, depending on what happens before the LSU game next year.
I don't know that I've seen – let me look. I don't know that I've seen Dungy. I saw Mahoney last year for the LSU game. Was that the only game I went to last year? I don't think so.
Yeah, I thought he went to a couple.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I went to a few. Last year was a – not the greatest year. I've seen. I think every if I've seen Dungy, I've seen every Syracuse quarterback going back to Robinson.
That's pretty solid.
So well, is it?
I mean, not really, but
which would be Dantley, or it was A-Rob, Dantley, And then Paulus, Nassib, and then I guess you would, after Nassib, it would be Drew Allen. Hunt.
I never saw Allen.
Oh, lucky you. Terrell Hunt, obviously.
Yeah.
And then AJ Long. Who else started that? I definitely saw Austin Wilson start.
You see Mitch Kimball?
No, I never saw Mitch Kimball. I did not see the Mitch Kimball game. He started, what, against Duke?
Yeah.
Yeah, wasn't at that one. So I missed Mitch Kimball, unfortunately. Was I at the Wake game last year? I think I was.
That sounds right.
Yeah, and I think Dungy started that. He had to, yeah.
Yeah, he did. That was his first start.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I was definitely... Oh, no, I wouldn't... Maybe. I don't remember.
Yeah. I'd like to see Dungy. I was really pissed and I didn't get to see him last year. Instead, I saw Mahoney. I saw Mahoney against NC State. I saw A.J. Long against Wake. And then I saw Terrell Hunt against Maryland in that really, really, really boring game down in College Park.
It was a really, really boring definitive win.
It was a definitive win. Which is nice. It's me and my buddies from college are down there kind of laughing at like the five Maryland fans left in the building by like the third quarter, yelling, "Where's our exit fee?" which was like, that's such like a point in time of like the realignment jokes and where every conference pretended we all loved each other. Like, just because you were just holding on to each other, praying nobody else left for like a 5-year stretch.
Well, it was like that, but like, I remember going to the last basketball game at UConn before we left the Big East. It was like, they clearly don't want us to leave, but they're also going to taunt us into like not leave. I don't know what their strategy was. It was like, how dare you leave this venerable conference that doesn't make any money and clearly is holding you back as a athletic department? Why would you ever leave?
Well, that was the big difference between them and like the ACC situation. Because like when Maryland was leaving, we're like, just get out because we want Louisville.
Yeah, like we're like, you know, it kind of sucks to like have someone leave on you, I guess. But like ACC, like we were pretty sure that the ACC would be able to upgrade because Louisville was waiting in the wings because the Big 12 decided they didn't want them. Which, looking back, looks funnier every day.
Actually, that's a good segue for what we talk about after we make some predictions. I figure we go into a little bit of other college football after this. So, Dan, given everything we've talked about with Wake or haven't talked about in some cases, what do you see happening in this one?
I'm going to say this one shakes out kind of similarly to the last couple of games. I'll give Wake a little more credit on offense because their offense has been, you know, somewhat better than it has been in the past, and our defense is a tire fire. I'm going to give Syracuse a 33-30 win at BB&T Field. And if that happens, I will have never lost to my brother in any... Well, I can't say that. He has another semester. But I will continue to not have lost a major sport to my brother in the Syracuse-Wake Forest Lions family rivalry.
I always wish I had one of those, and I don't, because my sister went to U. Yeah, my sister's finishing up at UMass, and there's no rivalry there. And then my brother has gone to a married...
Except that if there was, like, you probably wouldn't want to talk about it, because UMass has not been the kindest athletic department to Syracuse.
Also fair. And then there's my brother who's gone to a myriad of other schools that we don't even need to address. For me, I'm going with 31-27. This is going to look a lot like the UConn game in some ways. I know when I was talking to the guys over at Blogger So Dear, the Wake Forest blog for SB Nation, they were saying that their corners are terrible. And right away, my mind went to UConn and how Amba Edetawo completely abused Jamar Summers.
Who was not supposed to be terrible.
He was not supposed to be at all, but he
except that, like, I've now watched him for 2 weeks in a row and it hasn't been good.
No, like, he's not good. I mean, granted, I'd say that SU's offense presents one challenge for him, and Houston just being a much better team presents another, but just the same, I don't think you can really make a niche for yourself as someone who can defend receivers 6 feet or shorter. It doesn't sound like a niche that anyone really has much use for in college ranks or the pros.
No, you need to kind of be able to defend more than just Tavon Austin.
Yeah, that's not a great strategy, guy. But knowing that, I see Syracuse being able to move the football, but I wouldn't say we see like a market improvement over anything we've seen in the past few weeks. Maybe we get the running game going. I think it really depends on the weather too. I know some recent projections seem to suggest that Hurricane Matthew starts heading out to sea a little bit. So we'll see what happens. No pun intended. And yeah, I've got SU by a slim margin, but one that is a win gets us to 3-3, and gets us our first ACC victory of the year.
Yeah, I mean, Wake does defend the run quite well. Luckily for Syracuse, it doesn't even try to run when it's obvious it can't. So
yeah.
I think it'll, if in fact Wake has bad corners, which I'm not, you know, looking at the number, I haven't watched Wake for more than like a brief moment in time this year. It doesn't look like the numbers really bear that out, but like they've only played one like big time passing attack, and that's Indiana. And I mean, they won it, but they you know, they gave up 28 points, and I'm not sure exactly how is Sudfeld still at Indiana? I'm pretty sure he is, right?
That sounds right.
Yeah, not sure like how Indiana looked in that game, so we'll see. I trust the Blogger So Dear guys are not being coy when it comes to the cornerback play.
No, I mean, granted, they're probably like even more negative about the team than we are, and not like in a similarly like tongue in cheek way, not in like a F this team way, like I think a lot some other blogs might be, but. For them, yeah, they're pretty realistic, which is why I took that piece of information to heart.
It's not Sudfeld; it's Richard Lodeau, which I forgot about. Sudfeld, I think, is in the NFL, or he's somewhere. He still exists on the Sets Essential plane post his Indiana career.
The more you know. But as I mentioned before, you mentioned the Big 12, and I thought we'd get a chuckle out of today's non-news. I know somebody started spreading some nonsensical non-expansion news today.
I saw that. Yeah. That was fun. That was like brought me back to like 2011.
Yeah, the West Virginia bloggers.
Yeah.
Yeah, that they were saying that the Big 12 is willing to let Oklahoma walk because Nebraska was interested in coming back. that's stupid. And no, it's not going to happen. And then Frank the Tank was actually tweeting quite a bit about this. For those who remember, Frank kind of made his bones as one of the foremost experts on expansion and realignment, taking a very logical and realistic view of the schools out there and where they might end up. He's been right on a lot of different things, you know, many, many years before they happened. And I consider him one of the experts there, especially knowing that he does have some ties within the industry that can give him hints about some of these things. One of the things he pointed out tonight, though, when he was this is only like an hour ago, you know, where Dan and I are on pretty late tonight, is
oh my god, it's 1 a.m.
There you go. For you, it's 1 a.m. We're still cranking over here.
Thanks, Mets. Sorry, we're not supposed to talk about the Mets. That's moving true. On.
But what he brought up was if Texas and Oklahoma refuse to extend the grant of rights with any team that's added. And as a result, you're going to not expand. Why on earth wouldn't you, like, the eight schools that aren't UT and OU have an invested interest to expand right now, get paid, and then even if UT and Oklahoma leave, most of you don't have another landing spot. So why wouldn't you combine for the eight schools? You have the majority if you eight just vote yes.
You're right. I think when you have schools like Texas Tech and Oklahoma State who are tied to Texas and Oklahoma, or at least people tend to think they are in terms of like when, if the Pac-12 expands or the SEC expands or whomever, there's a possibility of those schools getting dragged along. Mm-hmm. That's still only four, so I'm not sure who else is you know betting on themselves here. But it's clear that even if the other schools don't believe that about their programs, the fact that there is a majority of schools, and I'm not sure what the voting necessity, you can correct me, like, is it just a simple majority in terms of...
Oh, no. It's 8 out of 10.
So, yeah. So the fact
that...
That's
the problem.
Okay, so it could just be Texas and Oklahoma.
Yeah, you could leave them on an island because they're gonna, because those two schools, if they have an opportunity, Texas and OU will go to the SEC or the Big Ten in a second. and say K-bye to everybody else in that conference. So to me, like, and Frank brings this up on his Twitter feed too, why wouldn't all of you say to yourselves, I'm going to act in my best interest, because that's usually what people do, and go, do I want to wait for them to screw us over? Or at least, since I know they're going to at some point, should I just shore up now? Like, I mean, especially if you're KSU, like, KSU is screwed. Like,
Iowa State
is screwed. Like, Baylor, to be honest, is also screwed. Like, there's
the schools
a lot
that aren't. Like, the only schools that are definitively probably not screwed are Texas, Oklahoma, maybe Oklahoma State.
Maybe
and
TCU.
Maybe TCU because they've been good enough, and maybe Kansas just because, like...
Kansas is fine because they're AAU.
They have really good basketball.
Yeah, they're fine.
And, like, the basketball is so good that, like, the Big Ten or ACC would probably be like, you know what, it's worth it, because, like, what's another garbage program when we're going to be... one of the four standing power conferences.
Right.
Like, at that point, adding Kansas football ain't that big a deal. When you're then adding, like, imagine the ACC with Kansas in it for basketball. I know basketball doesn't drive the bus, but, like, that's, like, it means more to the ACC than it does anyone else.
Adding Kansas basketball to the ACC would drive the bus.
It would drive a smaller bus. It would drive, like, ESPN being like, yeah, we'll take that, why not? And, you know... It doesn't help the football brand, but I don't think it really hurts it, especially when the ACC is about as strong in terms of football brand as it's been in a long time right now. Really, like, a really quick turnaround on that, too. I know me and you were both kind of believers in the ACC football product, even when it didn't look great, but and maybe that was just because we really wanted it to be good, because that's where Syracuse is going to end up, but... Like, ACC football is in really good shape, and the ACC overall is in pretty good
teams
shape
right now.
Yeah, and like a lot of them, you know, who knows what Miami looks like after this weekend? Who knows what Virginia Tech ends up being? But it's not like the top 25 is so deep where those teams look all that out of place based on what's happened.
And to be honest, like it's not just any six teams. It's not like some wacky ass year. Like these are the six teams that are supposed to be there, and that's kind of the underlying, you know, exclamation points of all this is that. Not only are there six teams there, but it's the six teams that absolutely need to be there in order for the conference to succeed.
Yeah, it's like the six that you would expect. And, you know, even same Florida State, and I kind of think Florida State's going to beat Miami this weekend, just because I think Florida State just has a talent advantage, and I think they'll get up for that game. But even if that happens, Miami's not going to fall out of the top 25. Yeah. Like, they're not. Now, if they slide, then maybe. But... You know, you have a UNC, which looks quite good after beating Florida State on the road. You have, obviously, Miami looks as good as it has in years. Who knows if that stands up with the actual schedule coming around now. Because, you know, beating Georgia Tech doesn't look all that great this year. Va Tech, like, I don't know where they're going to end up this year, but I think the poll, like, Fuente process is really bearing out. They look quite good. Being very early on in a pretty big offensive overhaul, probably not as big as Syracuse's, but still pretty big. So yeah, I think the ACC, like the fact that no one even comes close to mentioning the ACC being in trouble when like 2 years ago, common, like expansion theory was that if a Power Five went, it was going to be the ACC. And I always thought the Big 12 was the more vulnerable just based on the makeup of the league and the imbalance in what that league has.
It's held together by a TV contract and two large brands. I mean, and again, this is not new information for anybody listening, probably, but you look at the states that they're in, you look at the cities that those teams are in, there is no value to that conference outside of its presence in the state of Texas. And that only applies to the fact that the Horns are there. If the Horns left, nobody would care that they had four or five other programs in Texas, even if Houston showed up. Texas is the main attraction, Texas A&M being, you know, 1A or 1B, depending on the year. And if you don't have either of those, you don't matter.
Yeah. Baylor and TCU are nice, like, ornaments, and they've grown their appeal and their brands recently. But they're not, like, you're not going out there if you're the Pac-12 and saying, you know what, we're going to get in the TCU business right now. And that's going to be our big move because that's going to bring us Texas. It doesn't. Like, it's just, it's a nice program. It's, you know, a really solid fan base, but it's not the driving force in that state. It's Texas and A&M. Even, you know, you'll you can probably effectively argue that A&M, even if not as big as Texas, is still quite big just because, like, the SEC doesn't mess around. They brought them in for a reason. So, and they've, you know, it seems to have paid off. So, yeah. Big 12, not in great shape when they can't get that passed. It just, like, it just shows that there's just not the requisite interest in that league staying together. Like, it's, it just seems like everything that's happened in the last, like, 2 or 3 years is going toward in this inevitable march towards this league either breaking up or losing its punch and becoming, like, the Big East of old. Because if Texas and Oklahoma leave, like, that league, maybe it's better than the AAC, but it doesn't look a whole lot different.
No, and at that point, those two leagues should probably just merge.
Yeah, that'd probably be an interesting interesting conference.
Ideally, that's really all they could do at that point. You know, the same survival thing that Mountain West and Conference USA almost did 4 years ago, which was still, like, one of the more fun, like, as far as, like, wacky shit that almost happened. Like, that was actually, like, codified. It wasn't as, like, stupid as the Texas wants to be in the ACC rumors. That was actually, like, we drew this up, we agreed. We're going to have two conferences compete for a championship game at the end, and it's going to be awesome. And I was actually pretty excited about it. But, you know, then each conference kind of got picked apart. Mountain West lost. I mean, somebody should write a book about what that Mountain West could have been if nobody left. Utah, TCU, BYU, and Boise. That's one of the four best conferences in the country, probably. At least at the top.
It probably doesn't get the respect, and the depth is an issue, but, like, those teams are, I mean, proved to be pretty competitive with anyone most years. Like, that would have been fun.
Agreed. All right. That little foray into realignment conjecture is always a good time. Brings people back to the old days.
Yep. It's like a good off season, you know, in mid season here.
Yeah.
I'll talk about realignment whenever. I thoroughly enjoy realignment while also being super realistic about how stupid the whole thing is. Like, it's just so interesting to me, which is why I always end up, like, anytime it comes up, I always end up writing those articles, just because I'm fully enthralled by the idea of, like, how this stuff works, because it's so crazy, and no one really seems to know what they're doing, which is always fun.
Same here as somebody who kind of came up writing about it. But yeah, I think that's all we got. That was Dan. I'm John. Thanks for listening to Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. Dan, you have any final words for us before we head out?
No, if you see me in Winston-Salem, hopefully I'm not hiding under a roof avoiding a hurricane.
Agreed. Safe trip down, bud, and go
Orange. Thank you. Go Orange.